Okay, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for the evening, Peg M. of Bellevue, Nebraska. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Peg Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God, this is going to be a bad night, I can tell right away. Through the grace of God, and fellowship of people like you, and sponsorship, I have been sober since February the 4th, 1964. And it really, truly is through the grace of God, and I think that that's become more evident to me the longer that I have been sober and the more I have been able to get out of my own way, which for me is not easy. I want to thank Jack for asking me to come and speak here. When I accepted this, which was, I don't know, ages ago, a year and a half ago or something, I really didn't think about the fact that I would be sober 35 years yesterday. And I did not think about the fact that... I really didn't think about the fact that, you know how alcoholics are. We're never going to get into the metric system. We've got the decimal system is down pat, and we're not going to let go of it, you know. And so every 5 years we have to make a big hoopla out of being sober instead of just, like, going to dinner or something, which I love because I hate to cook. We have to have a big celebration, you know, and so... The people that I sponsor got very upset with me, although I didn't know it, and it was probably a good thing I didn't know it, but eventually they had to tell me that they were having this big party for me, and so Jack made arrangements for me to speak on Friday night, and I'm very grateful to him for that. I am a person who believes that when you go to a convention, you go to all of the meetings. However, this weekend... because of this celebration that they're having tomorrow night, I'm having to get up very early in the morning to take a flight back to, oh my God, Nebraska. And I want to thank J.W. and Robert for coming and picking me up at the airport, and I want to thank J.W. For taking me back in the morning, in the middle of the night, really, is what this amounts to. But the kindness of you know, I guess one of the most striking things to be about Alcoholics Anonymous is the fact that we are so full of incipient kindness. We can just hardly wait for it to break out. Now, you know, that was not what could be said of me when I was drinking, because I was hardly hospitable when I was drinking, but... when we get sober and after we get a little bit of taste of the grace of God in our lives, even though I didn't certainly recognize it as that for many, many years, we have these feelings that break through of kindness for our fellow man. We try hard to disguise those things because God, we don't want to be known as softies or anything, but I have seen people, go to extraordinary lengths in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, not only with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, but for people outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't shoot our wounded. And I'm certainly glad that we don't, because when I got here, I was very wounded. And since I've been here, I've been wounded. I mean, I don't know about you, but I didn't get wonderful. If I had gotten wonderful, I wouldn't have stayed. You know, every time I do something that just appalls me, I just look at it. You know, the thing about it is I still go to my meeting. You know, there are times when I have made a complete jerk of myself, and if you haven't, you're lying. I have always gone back to the meeting, you know, whether I wanted to or not. I have gone with red cheeks, embarrassment, humiliation, and snuck in the back, but I have gone. You know, I'm a person who, here's something interesting. This is a spiritual program. And if you look at the word spiritual and you take the SP off the SPI off the front, it's ritual. And ritual, for alcoholics, it has all these bad connotations, you know, but really, it just means a set of things that we do. And some of the things that I do is, it doesn't take any genius to go to another meeting. I mean, I just have gone to meetings consistently. Too dumb to do anything else, I guess. Just went to meetings, you know. I just went to meetings when I felt good, went to meetings when I felt bad, went to meetings when it rained, went to meetings when it was shining, went to meetings even during the Super Bowl, and it's like, I'm a tremendous football fan. Now, I don't know about if Nebraska plays. That might be a different story. I have called my sponsor for dispensation when Nebraska plays in a bowl game on the night of my home group. And I'll never forget it one time. It landed on Tuesday night, and I called her up because I knew a month in advance that we were going to play on that night. And I said, what do I have to do to get to have dispensation for that one Tuesday night? She said, you have to do two acts of kindness that you don't get caught at every day from now on. For months! I'll tell you something. Peeling Vic's fruit got to be pretty low on the... I mean, I did anything I could think of as acts of kindness. But I got to stay home that one night. So I have always done these things consistently. I have consistently gone to meet, and it's not because I'm a good person. I'm not a good person. I'm just a consistent person. I've consistently done what was in front of me. I've consistently gone to meetings, consistently called my sponsor, consistently sponsored people, and so forth. And many, many, many times, the phrase, meeting makers make it, has crossed through my mind. Many times. Because it's in the meeting where the solution is. For that particular period of time, try as I might, something besides my self-centeredness is going to come through. I will hear something. Some small something. And it's usually, you know, it doesn't matter who it's from. If I'm there because I need to be there, if I'm there not because of you, but because of my desire to be there. If I'm there for that reason, and I'm listening, if I'm in the room, I will hear something from the most unlikely sources. From the newest newcomer. Chuck, who's going to be your Sunday morning speaker, and who has given me nothing but trouble ever since I got here, because I'm not going to be here to hear him talk. Not to speak of Mr. B from Minneapolis, or St. Paul, I'm sorry, who also gave me a lot of you-know-what, because I'm not going to be here. But it's only because they love me. Chuck comes to our meeting in Bellevue, Nebraska, when he comes down to Omaha on trips. And, I don't know, it was, 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago, we had a young man at the front table who was as close to convulsions as I had seen in a long time. And it was unbelievable. This kid was shaking so bad. And just, it was, I have not seen somebody that bad in a long time. And I mean, all I could think of, I was like a nervous mother. You know, I was running up there and shoving chocolate at this kid's face. You know, just, eat this chocolate, Brian, eat this chocolate. And he was just like shoving this chocolate in his face. And like this, it was bouncing out. And Chuck said, I thought if you shove one more piece of chocolate in him, he was going to throw up all over you, you know, because we... But then Chuck came back 6 weeks later and Brian was still there. And he was sober. And Chuck had to ask somebody who he was. Because he was irrecognizable from the young man who was sitting there before. This is a big, scary world. And it's different. But when I walk in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I want it to be the same. I want it to be a safe, well-lighted place. And I have seen respect for Alcoholics Anonymous diminish as respect has diminished outside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want the respect for the spirit that drives this to be present in these rooms. I want to listen when the steps are read. I want to listen to whoever is talking. I want to be sure to thank the speaker. I want to be sure to encourage people to read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want it to be a safe, well-lighted place. My son, is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My husband and I met in AA. We had a son. He is now a member of AA for almost 10 years. It'll be 10 years in March. My son and his wife met in Alcoholics Anonymous. They have two children. And once in a while, my grandson gets to come to the meeting. When somebody's getting a chip, maybe grandma or maybe mom, he gets to come to the meeting. And you know what he does? He goes up to his room and he gets his tie. And he puts on his tie. To him, Alcoholics Anonymous is a place where you wear a tie, where it's safe and it's respectful. If my kid never does anything else, it's worth it. Because that's the message. You know, just recently, I've sponsored a woman for 23 years. I have known her for 25. A month ago, she was diagnosed with adenocarcinoma, which is a terribly aggressive cancer, and we probably will not have her long. But she will never die because she lives on in the people that she's helped. So that none of us will ever really die if we'll just help somebody. I think in every alcoholic, it's this idea that we want to make a difference. Even if it's just a little difference. I know it's the something I was looking for years. It's just to make a difference. And I know that this woman has made a difference in my life. And in talking with her and sharing with her, I started reading this book. And it's called Kitchen Table Wisdom. And you remember how in your family, you used to sit around the kitchen table and talk and talk. And your grandma would talk and your grandpa would talk. And you'd think, oh, this is so boring. You know, there's all these stories about all these people. But in the talking and in the telling of our stories in our families, we passed on the wisdom. We passed it down. We became a sense, there was a sense of family. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. We tell our stories. We give the greatest gift that we can give to another human being, which is the emotion that we feel about our lives. And they become a part of ours. And we become a part of them. I want that to go on forever, as it was in the beginning, for us to pass it on to the next person. The wisdom of our stories. The emotion of our lives. I don't mean to be weepy. I am really great, very, very grateful to be sober 35 years. It's just that I realize how important every single day and every single breath is. So, you know, what you got is you've got this person. I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I am a bad alcoholic. I seem to sponsor all bad alcoholics, and my sponsor was a bad alcoholic. And I don't know, they just seem to kind of come to me. And it's partly because I was, it says in the book, the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. Now, that says to me that the mind of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his body. So it doesn't make any difference. We're abnormal. We're not normal people. And 35 years ago at this time, everything in my body had ceased functioning. Everything. I drank so much alcohol that I could not cry because I was so dehydrated I had no tears. I mean, literally, I blinked my eyes and it was just scraped over dry eyeball because it was dry. I mean, I had no tears. I had not, you know, peed in a long time. All of my skin was flaking off. I had my sister about a month or two before I got sober. I was drinking white rum. Remember the white rum? Not blackstrap rum, but I mean white rum. I'm sitting there on the floor. She says, "You need, let's do something with your hair. Maybe if we do something with your hair, you'll feel better about yourself and you won't be such a lush, you know." My family was always a close family. Still are. And she said, "Why don't we frost your hair?" Well, you know, this is my idea of dressing up. You know, it's really just nothing but a big sweatshirt, but that's my idea of dressing up. And so she said, I mean, I didn't know for nothing. My hair died. My hair had died. Remember? I mean, the women. When you drink as much as my hair, it looked like big things of shredded wheat stuck on my head. And I mean, just... And she said, "You need to have something done." And I, you know, I had a drinking uniform. It wasn't really a uniform, but I couldn't be bothered to get out of it. You know, it was a blue sweater, blue turtleneck sweater, gray stretch pants. And I had spilled something orange down the front of this thing. And I have that sweater today. It's my own personal archives. I have my own archives. I think I threw the gray stretch pants out because, you know, they got a little soiled. And I had on my blue sweater and my gray stretch pants, and she pulled this hair through holes in this shower cap. And, you know, big, we weren't professional, of course, you know, I mean, she's my sister. She pulled these big hunks of hair through there, you know, and she put stuff on it, and you're supposed to sit, you know, I'm sipping my white rum, and she goes, "Oh, oh," and I said, "What's the matter?" She said, "Something funny has happened." She said, "Let me try again." So she put the stuff on. You drink as much as I do. The alcohol goes out through through the protein pathways, and your hair is a protein pathway. And I mean, it just that you know, your hair, when people talk about their hair being drunk, it is. I mean, it is. You have all these little things in your head, you know, these neurons, and they tickle. They have arms, like, and they like tickle one another like this. And when you drink, they don't like it. They tickle at these things called synapses, and you have like billions of these in your brain. Think about it. Billions of these in your brain. They're all waving their arms at each other like this. And when you drink, these things go, eek, eek, eek. And it sparks. These little arms make sparks. And the sparks jump across and enable us to breathe and remember where we parked the car and stuff like that. And when these things draw back like this and the spark zaps across, it fries the ends of these things. So they kind of sizzle like bacon, you know, kind of goes. I have good news and bad news. Should you choose to drink again, you're going to remember that. You're going to be sitting in a bar and you're going to hear. Anyway, if it does that to your neurons, think of what it does to your hair. And my hair, when they put this stuff on, she put this chemical on my hair. It had this strange reaction, and it turned bright bozo orange. So I had big coin-shaped orange dots all over my head. And my hair was in such terrible condition that it broke off and fell out in these orange places. And when I got sober, it itched. And so I came into Alcoholics Anonymous kind of like this. I mean, I literally scratched holes in my head because I, you know. And I remember getting dressed to go to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting at the Church of St. Albans on the grounds of the Washington Cathedral in D.C. And I walked in the door, and this woman walked up to me, and she looked at me, and she said, "You look new." Like the newcomer in the skit, which was wonderful. Thank you, all of you. I digress. This skit was wonderful. I mean, that was the best thing. When I got sober and I met my husband, each of us had our favorite songs. Remember that goofy damn stuff when we were little, young, I mean? I had my, guess what my song was? Wild Thing by the Trolls. Anyway, so Jane walked up to me and said, "You look new." And I was so insulted, you know, because I thought I looked pretty good. And she said, if you're new, you need a sponsor, and I'm your sponsor. You know, there are people who take me out to lunch now and interview me to see if I'm appropriate. Isn't that funny? As if God wasn't in charge. I mean, I didn't know this woman. She was a complete stranger to me. And she walked up to me and stuck out her hand and told me she was her sponsor. I had no idea what a sponsor was. I had no idea. She just took me by the hand and kind of dragged me through the crowd. And I don't know how you were at your first meeting. I walked in the door like it was this room in the back, and it was almost as though the whole room went dark. And then this spotlight came on, and there was a drum roll. And I walked in. This spot followed me around the room like I was the only one in it. And everything negative that I had showed in this spotlight. I was that self-centered. And Jane Holler took me under her wing. And I was scared of her, too. She had this helmet of silvery gray hair that had, you know how they used to marcel hair? Oh, years and years ago, eons ago. They had these machines that were like silver tops, and they had all these electric wires that hung down like this, and they had these pincher things and they put you under this thing like devil's torture or something. You looked like you were getting a lobotomy or something like that. And they had these, and it put permanent crimps in people's heads. You know, so then they arranged their hair to lay over the crimps. You know, that's the way I look. And she had this silver helmet of hair with these waves in it, like a waffle arm, you know, kind of like that. And I thought if she ever really got mad at me, that she would just lower her head and ram me. You know, and I just had this big waffle marks on my stomach. Sponsor abuse, you know, that kind of thing. But I did what she told me. And, you know, that's an amazing thing. Because I'm a little nuts. I mean, I'm still a little... I'm a bubble off a plum. I don't care. I mean, I'm helpful. And I have discovered that there's a lot of people... What are you laughing at, Steve? There's a lot of people who are a bubble off a plum. You know, one brick short of a load. One quart low. Whatever. Wouldn't it be... And we're here. Look, we're all grouped. Wouldn't it be something... Have you ever thought about this? I mean, this is a kind of an aside, but have you ever thought about this? What if we were to ever... God forbid, but what if we were to ever get organized? We could drive them into rooms like this. But oh, I shudder to think. Where was I? So James, I did what she told me. I'm a human dichotomy. I don't know if any of you can relate to this or not. But I think one of the reasons that I love to drink was because it sort of put me together. It kind of made me, whole, or maybe feel not quite so fractured, because I felt fractured all my life. Because on the one hand, I was bright. On the other hand, I thought I was dumb. And on the one hand, I'm extremely aggressive. I love football. I like John Madden football. I like guys that get blood on them. I like to put blood on them. I like football helmets with big chunks of dirt hanging out. I don't like AstroTurf. I want dirt. I like guys that blow their nose on the ground. I like that. I like them to do that. That's really an art, because they can put their nose and just go right back to the huddle. And nobody cares. They just get in there. And I like them to smash through the line and break people's heads and stuff. I like that. I like that. I like to beat people up when I was little. I like to beat people up. I there's this guy that was in my elementary school, and I was in charge of taking up money for the Berlin Candy Lift. And that dates me. We were 100% except for this guy. He was a big pear-shaped guy. Big pear-shaped guy. Big old hips. Teeny little old tiny head. Looked like a big avocado. And he wore high-water jeans and white shirt. And he wore tennis shoes with lightning bolts on the side. We called him Flash. And he didn't bring in his money, and I said, if you don't bring in your money tomorrow, you meet me outside the school, and I'm going to beat you up. He weighed like 600 pounds, And I weighed 56 pounds in the sixth grade. My teachers used to say things like, good things come in small packages. He didn't bring in his money. The next day, he was passing. I hid behind the hedge outside Randolph Elementary School, Randolph Air Force Base, Texas. And when he passed by, I jumped out of those bushes, and I landed on his back, and I took my fist, and I smashed it up into his nose just like that. And I felt the blood come, and I rode him to the ground. I just rode him to the ground. Lack of power. That was our dilemma. Funny but true. But that sense of power that I got from that was exhilarating. And I got that same feeling when I drank. And so, here I am, this football nut, the belligerent, and yet I took 12 years of classical piano. I was certified, played concert piano. I also love to paint to this day. I'm a watercolorist. I love painting big florals, beautiful airy florals, beautiful colors, teals and pinks and soft, and yet I have season tickets to the Nebraska football games. There's a certain dichotomy there, It's like I love going to Swan Lake. I just love that, the wonderful grace and beauty of ballet. And yet when I dance, I like wild things. So I have this split kind of personality. And when I drank, it kind of all came together. I felt whole. I'm still to this day very right-brained. I'm very, I think a lot of alcoholics are. I think in pictures. I see things before I can put them into words. And life was painful to me. it was scary to me. I was a creature of great fear and great anger and huge self-pity. And so self-centered. I love that song. You know, what about me? You know, enough about you. Let's talk about me. You know. And I think of myself as like Miss Piggy. You know, Miss Piggy from Sesame Street, isn't it? Yes. Where she talks about, you know, wah. And she sweeps her piggy hair back. You know, it's just like, wah. And that's even today. And it says in our book of Alcoholics Anonymous, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem. Not was. Or 20 years ago it occurred to me that I was. Now. And so I need Alcoholics Anonymous. I need meetings. I will always need meetings. I will always want meetings. I feel better in a meeting. Why would I not go someplace where I feel good? I love going to meetings. I like going to meetings because people in meetings, sometimes they're nuttier than I am. And it makes me feel better to be there. Sometimes there are people there that can be helpful to me. Sometimes I can be helpful to others. But I feel good in meetings. I want to be in meetings. So, you know, I get to go to meetings. I believe it's a privilege. I don't think it's a right. There have been times in my sobriety when I have taken that very gift, that very freedom, for granted. And if you're sitting in here saying, not me, it's either because you haven't been sober very long or you're lying again. Because I think alcoholics like bad alcoholics like I am, we never ever make it. Not really. We never ever get well. Not really. Because, you know, we got this little, like, lizard brain. I don't know if it's actually a lizard brain, but it's a part of our brain that has been passed on to us from when we first crawled on shore. I mean, this is true. Bob's very smart. He'll tell you it's true. He reads a lot. There's stuff back here, way back here. Here is the lizard brain. And in it are stored all of the things that make me who I am. In one little place. Tiny little place. And you can't live without it. So to take it out would be to destroy me. And way back in that little brain is this thought. I know what'll make it better. That's why I have to go to meetings. That's why I get to go to meetings. Is because I'm an alcoholic with a lizard brain. And when things get tight, and I am not in fit spiritual condition, wouldn't it be wonderful? I mean, I don't know about here, but I know in Nebraska there are guys that you would think they were so spiritual they never had a terrible thought. They never swore, never lusted, never, you know, felt sorry for themselves. I mean, they were so spiritual that I absolutely cannot relate to them. But I'm not like that. And I don't think you are either. So I'm never going to graduate from beyond where I am. I'm a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a meeting because they've insisted on getting together to have a good time. You know what? That's another thing that skit made me think of. We love to hoop it up. I mean, when we were through in here, the serotonin level in this room just shot sky high. You know, who needs Prozac? Let's have a little skit. You know, that's the idea. You get the going. You know, there's like three or four things that get serotonin going. You know what they are, and all of them alcoholic. We love them. One is exercise. Two is laughter. Three is sex. And I forget what the other one is. But it's true. We love that. Look at that. I mean, we had it all together, didn't we? We had a little sex, we had a little exercise, and we had a lot of laughter during that skit. And we all felt good, didn't we? We can do that anytime we want. You know, another deal of Alcoholics Anonymous is altered attitudes. And I don't know how your attitude was when you got here, but I know how mine was. I was a depressive with bad days. I mean, the nature of the alcoholic, as self-centered as we are, is depressive. You know, I still wonder, you know, you go to the doctor and he says, well, you seem depressed. Well, yes. I mean, who wouldn't be? But when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, what was there to be glad about? You know, it brings me to another thing. People talk in AA sometimes how they came into the golden gates of AA and like surrendered, you know, just kind of like surrendered. Well, that's not what happened to me. Before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, just outside the door, I was at a place in my life where I had absolutely no better ideas. I was out of ideas. Out of ideas. I could not think of another way to drink and get away with it and not have consequences. I was done. Out of ideas. No ideas. No better ones. None. Period. Zip. Zilch. I had been surrendered. And there's a big difference. Because when I surrender, it's like, okay. All right. Okay. I'll do it. For now. Maybe just a little bit. Hey, folks, I'm not talking about 1 year sober, 1 minute sober. I'm talking about 5 years sober, 10 years sober, 13 years sober, 20 years sober. I'm talking about life as an alcoholic lives it. We don't surrender. We are surrendered. We comply. We wait till the heat's off. We act like we're going to do it until they leave us alone. And then we carry on following the lizard brain. We don't have any little overriding id or whatever that thing is. We're just ego. And aren't we all like that? It's amazing to me. I'm sure glad we don't shoot our wounded because we'd all be dead. So I got sober and I got a sponsor and I started going to meetings and I got involved and I met and married my husband, he's still alive, in spite of my best efforts, no. And he got sober in 1965, I got sober in 1964, so he brings me my coffee every morning. He said he made a terrible mistake by marrying somebody that's been sober longer than he is. And many of you, some of you anyway, know him. And he's a very conservative person. I bought him a tie for Christmas and normally, you know, he wears those rep stripe ties. I think that's what they're called. And this one, the stripes went this way. Well, it was almost too much. He is very left brain. I'm very right brain, but because of him, we get to work, you know, and because of me, we have fun. But when we were first married, we didn't have any money, and it was Christmas, and we weren't going to give each other any Christmas presents because we didn't have any money. We had $6. Well, it was more in those days, but even so, $6 is not much. And so he came home from work. We had an efficiency apartment, and he came in and he said, "I got you a present." Well, of course, I got mad because I didn't have anything for him, and I felt sorry for myself and guilty and, you know, the whole all in 10 seconds. And he went in the bathroom, and within a very few seconds, he came. The bathroom door banged open, and he jumped out, and he was stark naked. And he had a big red bow tied, you know where. And he goes, "Here comes Santa Claus." So he taught me how to laugh. Remember when you first laughed? I remember my first meeting where I laughed. This woman was speaking. She was from, she's from D.C., and she's still sober and still alive and just a great woman. And she said, "My name's Evelyn. And oh, and my sponsor made me sit where that lady with the red sweater is. I sit in that chair in my meeting today. I just don't know. I don't want to change my luck. You know, 35 years, I'm sitting in that seat." And she made me sit there because, like, the lady right behind her, that's where my sponsor sat, and if I got up to leave, she would trip me. I didn't know that for a long time, but that's why she sat me where I was. And because I had to pay attention, you know, because it was hard for me to pay attention. Anyway, this woman said, "My name's Evelyn, and I'm from the city of brotherly love. And when I was drinking, I some kind of loved them brothers." And I laughed. I mean, but it was like I didn't even know it was me. It was like the sound came, you know, like that. And I was so tight. You know, I mean, remember how tight? I just sit with my little arms crossed like this and my little feet, my little legs crossed like this, and every once in a while, you know, I'd have these intention tremors, and my foot would go out like that, kick people going by and stuff. It was terrible. I was so tense, and when I laughed, it was like everything I just let go. And somebody remarked many years later, "Have you ever? Laughter is God's music." Because when you're laughing, when I'm laughing, when I am really laughing, I can't feel any other emotion but joy. Just in that minute. I might feel sorry for myself the moment before, but in that moment, you know, I am really close to God. And I think it is truly God's music. It's part of the wisdom of the message. It's part of the story that we have to carry on, to pass on to other people. And I laughed, and I've been laughing ever since. And I just have a couple of stories, and then we'll quit. And I really thank you for having me. It's been a kind of a stressful month because of this lady that I sponsor and some other things, but mainly that. Because I love her. And I have known her for such a long time. I don't know about you, but I never had any kind of long-term anything because I was so afraid it would break my heart. As this crazy, mixed-up alcoholic, you know, I've got this part of me, even today, that is afraid for pain. It's a much smaller part of me today than it was. At one time, it engulfed me. But I dared not feel too much for fear it would hurt my heart. And I have given that up. I love this woman. I love many of you. And I'm not afraid to do that with all the inherent risks. My father's 89 years old, and he's one of my heroes. My mom's 87, and the same. They're getting older, and they will die soon, as will Joel. And my life has been so enriched by their presence. My father called me the other day, and he said, "Come over. You need to talk to your mom." And I said, "Why?" "I live across the street." He said, "She threw up on the floor. She had the flu. And you need to talk to her." I said, "Dad, she's sick." Now, he's a doctor. He never lets you in the house when other people are sick. There's germs, you know. He doesn't want anyone around when people are sick. And I went over there, and when I got there, I understood. He didn't want to ask me for help because he's 89 and he can't get down on the floor and scrub it up. And so when I went there, I just hugged him and I said, "Dad, never be afraid to just say, 'Peggy, I need your help.'" I said, "Dad, please. Look what you did for me." He said, "I love you, and it was my duty." And I said, "Oh, no, it was a lot more than that." So I'm not afraid to let that hurt, because I have long ago made those amends to that man. Long ago. It's the least I can do. So, the weller I get, I suppose, the more open my heart is, the freer I am from the bondage of self. Isn't that what we're talking about? And I'm still full of character defects. I like to say that I'm a person of passions. But really, I just have a lot of character defects. And I like flying, but I'm afraid of crashing and burning. And I fly a lot. And this one time I was flying to Little Rock, Arkansas, and it was a bad day. It was just I was about 20 years sober, I think, and it was just terrible. It was snow. It was ice on the runway. I'm in this plane that looks like a dragonfly. I mean, they like, in Kansas City, they came to the pilot who looked like that guy out of Airplane. He said, "We're going to have to balance the aircraft." So they put one big fat guy over here, and all the rest of us are on the other side of the plane. And so we take off, and it's really rough, and they try to land at Fayetteville, Arkansas, which is in the mountains of Arkansas, and they come down, and I mean, I feel like Red Fox, you know. I'm coming. And I'm clutching my medallion, and I'm praying, you know. I'll never swear again. I'll cook dinner for Dick every night, I promise you. I mean, we'll anything, you know how it is. But, and I heard this crackling sound behind me, and I turn around and I look, and there's a woman, and she has a brown paper bag, and she pulled a bottle of Smirnoff vodka out of it, and she took the lid off, and she took a big slug out of it, and I felt better. God sent me that woman. Seriously. Because I have never been that terrified to fly again. I've been frightened, but I have not been terrified. I was out in San Jose. I was speaking on Saturday night. I didn't know they had such big conventions up there. I thought they were smaller. And they kept announcing the registration. You know, they ended up 5,000 people Saturday night. 10,000 eyeballs. And I'm up there. And we're sitting outside in this amphitheater watching this play called Sadie the South or Susie the South or something. They're singing and dancing and leaping around. But I'm humming, you know, because I'm thinking 10,000 eyeballs, and what am I going to say, you know, and I've got this thing going in my brain, you know. Oh, you're going to get up there and not be able to say anything. You're going to faint for the first time. You're not going to be able to say anything. Blah, blah, blah. They won't pay your airfare. You'll have to walk home to Nebraska. Back and forth. You know, what are you going to say? Go Big Red. You know. And all of a sudden, I felt something wet hit my hand. I looked up, and there wasn't a cloud in the sky. I looked down. It was white. And this lady sitting next to me was a friend of mine, said, "Ooh, ooh, a bird has crapped on your back." Dig around. And it was a seagull. Well, you know what they eat. It was just okay. It was all right. For some people, birds sing. My God was saying, "Hey, you're just an alcoholic from Nebraska. Just get up there and tell them about your bird story." And that's what I did. And all they wanted to see was like the splotch on my breath. I was gifted, when I was born with a sense of humor, which had been drowned, literally, in oceans of vodka. And since I have been in Alcoholics Anonymous, that has been restored to me. That wonderful sense of humor, which allows me to laugh myself right out of myself. And I am so grateful that, you know, God gives us these things. To every one of us. He gives us situations in which we're challenged to see the Spirit of God. And those are two instances in which I could have easily felt sorry for myself or gotten angry or done a lot of things. But instead of that, I just simply saw the Spirit there. I saw God in those events. And to wrap it up, my husband and I, some 5 years ago, something like that, we were invited to speak in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And there's a wonderful restaurant there called the Captain's Table, and it's in a little house right on the Atlantic. And there's a seawall behind it, and they had a huge construction light because they were building onto the place in the back, and there was this big, bright light that was shining out to sea. And, of course, I love the ocean. So I, got out of the car and ran down to the seawall. And when I got down there, I saw this light. And in the path of this light were literally thousands and thousands of seagulls. It was dark everywhere else, but they were all sitting in the light. So, I was astounded. And in my brain, I say, there's something spiritually significant here, but what is it? I'm a binge thinker. I get to thinking about something, and it's like I think it to death almost, But I didn't have very long, so I couldn't overthink it too much. So I went in, and we went into the thing, and I said to the waitress, "What's with the birds?" And she said, "Well, we don't know, but we think it's the light." Of course it's the light.
we doing here? What are we doing here? Thousands and thousands and thousands of us sitting in the safety of the light. Thank you so much.